It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is Ari Berman, senior contributing writer for The Nation, also author most recently of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari joins us by phone from New York City. Ari, glad to have you with us, and I'm sure it's a pleasure for you to get back in touch with your native Iowans.
Absolutely. Great to talk to you, Ben, and I'm very excited about the college football season upcoming.
What in particular?
Well, Hawkeyes are going to go undefeated again, but this time they're not going to lose in a bowl.
Okay, we'll watch that. Let's talk voting rights, the topic of this half hour. If you'd like to join us and have a question or comment for Ari, 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Recently, federal courts, Ari, have struck down voting restrictions in six states. You've written about this in The Nation. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump says this will lead to a record number of fraudulent votes for Hillary Clinton in November. Here's what Donald Trump had to say about the rulings a few days ago. This is at a rally in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Voter ID. What's with that? What's with voter ID? Why aren't we having voter ID? In other words, I want to vote. Here's my identification. I want to vote, as opposed to somebody coming up and voting 15 times for Hillary. Well, and I will not tell you to vote 15 times. I will not tell you to do that. Okay? You won't vote 15 times. But people will. They'll vote many times. And how that could have happened is unbelievable.
Okay, Donald Trump recently in North Carolina. Ari, you wrote an article I just read in the Washington Post recently titled, Donald Trump is Wrong. Rigging an Election is Almost Impossible. And in that piece, you write about a number of things. Let's address that question that you look at in the piece, is just how easy would it be to rig a presidential election?
So, I mean, given how Trump is faring in the polls, if anything, he's a candidate that needs people to vote 15 times for him. But the fact is that voter fraud is a very small problem in American elections. People make it sound like it's a huge and widespread problem, but it's a very small problem. There have been very few elections that have been swung by voter fraud in recent decades. Voter impersonation, which is the type of fraud that Trump is talking about, that people show up and vote 10 or 15 times, as he says, is virtually non-existent. There have been a lot of studies on this, and there have been, since 2000, only 31 cases of voter impersonation out of a billion votes cast. So it's not a major problem, and it's a misnomer to say that no ID is required. Everyone has to show some proof of who they are at the polls, whether it's their name and their address or their signature or some sort of ID, whether it's a bank statement or a driver's license or a utility bill. So every state requires some sort of ID. And voter impersonation, which is you go and you say you're someone else and you vote multiple times, that's an incredibly inefficient and stupid way to steal an election. If you vote more than once in my name or your name, you're going to get caught and you're only going to be able to swing one or two extra votes. So it doesn't make sense. And what the courts have said, whether it's in Texas or North Carolina or in other states, is that these voter ID laws are not really meant to stop voter fraud because there's such a small number of voter impersonation cases to begin with. But in fact, they're disenfranchising lots of people. They are blocking low-income people, voters of color, students from the polls. And that's why courts, both Republican and Democratic judges, have invalidated these laws in recent weeks.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit more in detail about the court cases. Why, for instance, do we have this whole slew of courts ruling on these voting rights issues? Because they are different cases? Are they dealing with different state restrictions, or are they pretty much the same, copied over into different states?
So what happened is, beginning after the 2010 election, we began to see a wave of new voting restrictions introduced in states like Iowa and in states like Wisconsin and in southern states all across the country. And basically, these restrictions did a bunch of different things. They not only required strict voter ID, but they cut back on early voting. They made it harder to register to vote in states like Iowa. They disenfranchised ex-offenders. And so we saw that half the states in the country passed some sort of new voting restriction after the 2010 election. Then after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013 and said that those states with the longest histories of discrimination, largely in the South but not exclusively, that they no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government, we began to see more restrictions introduced and more sweeping restrictions introduced in places like North Carolina. And so many of these cases were coming before the courts for the first time in the 2016 election. And because we're not that far away from the election, courts have to rule on these laws to tell voters what the rules will be. And so we saw that many courts have been ruling on these restrictions in late July and early August, and I anticipate some more decisions coming soon. And with a few exceptions, they have basically said that the Republican Party has gone too far, that by requiring strict ID or cutting early voting or making it harder to register to vote, they have burdened many more people than cases of voter fraud that they're purporting to stop.
Mm-hmm. What is an acceptable level, if I can put it that way, of voting fraud? I've had the former Secretary of State here in Iowa, Matt Schultz, on who would maintain that, you know, even one case of voter fraud is not acceptable.
Well, let me put it this way. Because, for example, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals dealt with this in North Carolina. And they found that in North Carolina, in the 2014 election, there were 2,300 documented cases of people who were turned away from the polls by new voting restrictions. In comparison, they found only two cases of voter impersonation from 2002 to 2012. So you could argue two cases is too many. However, 2,300 cases of people were disenfranchised by these new restrictions. So the way I would look at it is there a good, compelling reason to make it harder to vote, and how many people are going to be affected? And so I think if you have two cases of voter impersonation but thousands of people turned away from the polls, that's an example of a law making it harder to vote that's not really needed, that there are probably other ways to ensure the integrity of the election that are less burdensome, that will disenfranchise fewer voters, because voter fraud remains a very small problem in American elections. But the fact is, we have seen evidence of thousands of people who are now being burdened in terms of their fundamental right to vote.
Mm-hmm. And we know these are legitimate voters.
We know these are legitimate voters. These are voters in places like North Carolina who have voted in previous elections. But because the law has changed, they are not able to vote because they don't have strict forms of government-issued ID, or they used same-day voter registration, like Iowa has, to show up and register. And when that's no longer there, they miss the registration deadline, or they voted in the wrong precinct where their vote would have been counted previously. I mean, these are things we have seen evidence that when the law changes, that people have a hard time adjusting, that they either can't meet the law, or they're actually too many burdens for them to be able to participate. And I mean, and just look in Iowa. When Iowa decided that ex-offenders could not vote, tens of thousands of people lost their voting rights. I mean, tens of thousands of people are unable to vote in Iowa now who would have been able to vote before Governor Branstad overturned Governor Vilsack's executive order that enfranchised ex-offenders. So there's an example of tens of thousands of people that just can't vote now because of something that Iowa did.
Mm-hmm. The governor, and he has on this problem, makes the case, and others representing the Republican Party here in Iowa, that it's a what they describe as a simple questionnaire they have to go through to apply to have their voting rights restored. Why isn't this a path that works, in your opinion?
Well, the fact is, it's not working. That the data that I have seen is that from 2011 to 2015, 25,000 ex-offenders completed their sentences, but only 119 people had their voting rights restored by Governor Branstad. So the program is not working. People either don't know that they can eventually get their voting rights restored, or it's too burdensome. And that's why Governor Vilsack decided to make this automatic, that if you have paid your debt to society, you would automatically get your right to vote back, which I think, regardless of what party you're for, makes complete common sense. Why are we releasing people if we're not going to give them their rights back? I think this is incredibly punitive. These felon disenfranchisement laws have their roots in Jim Crow. They are incredibly discriminatory. If you look at Iowa, for example, African Americans in Iowa are 3% of the population, but 26% of the state's prison population. So they are going to be disproportionately disenfranchised by these restrictions. And I just don't think it makes sense that you're going to release someone but not give them their rights back.
Mm-hmm. And in particular, this case that made its way to the Iowa Supreme Court was decided on a 4-3 decision along pretty much party lines, if we can say that about the court. This was a case of a woman, Kelly Jo Griffin of Montrose, Iowa, who voted when she shouldn't have because, what, she thought she was under the Vilsack rules and had her voting rights automatically restored?
Yeah, she thought she had her voting rights restored, and it turned out she didn't, and then she was prosecuted by previous Secretary of State for committing voter fraud. She was within 45 minutes, the jury ruled for her and said that she did not knowingly commit voter fraud. But the fact is, as an ex-offender, she can still not vote in Iowa. And she is someone who admitted that she made a mistake, has cleaned her life up, took her stepdaughter with her to vote. And what kind of message does it send to her and people like her who want to rehabilitate themselves that they still can't vote, that even after they have paid their debt to society, they still don't have their rights back? I think that this should not be a political issue. I think this is a moral issue. And I think it's immoral that after people have paid their debt to society, they are still treated like criminals when they're on the outside.
When we look at Iowa, how does Iowa compare to other states in terms of giving the vote back automatically or permanently banning ex-felons from voting?
Well, Iowa is one of only a few states that does this. Only Iowa, Florida, Kentucky, and Virginia have laws that ban ex-offenders from voting unless they go through a very long process to try to get their voting rights back, where the governor will restore them on a case-by-case basis. And with the exception of Virginia, these governors are just not restoring people's voting rights in a large number. So I think it's sad because Iowa has some really good reforms in place, like Election Day registration. It has a culture of high turnout. It has a culture of pretty clean government. And so I think it's sad that on this particular issue, Iowa is one of only a few states that has this very, very punitive and outdated law preventing tens of thousands of people from voting.
Mm-hmm. How much of an impact, given this slew of federal court rulings in recent weeks, how much of an impact might these rulings have on this election? I suppose it would most apply. You would want to look at swing states, battleground states like Iowa.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, these restrictions, whether they're overturned or in place, are going to have an impact. In my view, that's the wrong way to initially think about it. I think we should be thinking, are we making it harder to vote for a very good reason? And if not, we should be instead making it easier to vote. So that's how I approach the issue, first off. But secondly, there's clearly a partisan dimension here, that Republicans overwhelmingly have passed these laws, that Democratic constituencies are usually most impacted, particularly younger voters, first-time voters, and voters of color. And so in a state like North Carolina, for example, where the court overturned a strict voter ID law and reinstated same-day registration and a week of early voting, that is something that impacts tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of voters. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people used early voting, used same-day registration, or didn't have strict forms of ID. In Iowa, it's a smaller number. I mean, you're talking about the fact that, you know, 20,000, 50,000 people don't have their voting rights who previously would have had their voting rights. We don't know how those people would vote. But if it's a very close election, you have to wonder if it would have made a difference. And so I think we have seen examples, whether it's in Florida in 2000 or Ohio in 2004, where voting laws have become more restrictive, where there were problems at the polls, where there were very close elections, and these kind of voting restrictions had an impact. So I don't know if this election will be close enough for it to have an impact, but I do know that hundreds of thousands of voters are impacted by the laws changing in different states.
Mm-hmm. Whether we're talking about, depending on the restriction, voter ID, early voting, or same-day registration, do restrictions always tend to favor the Republican candidate?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the Republican party is doing this because they think it's going to help them politically. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't be doing it. There are some constituencies that can be burdened by these laws that do vote reliably Republican, like elderly voters. So sometimes the GOP may be disenfranchising some of their own, but I think, you know, they're looking at the data and they're seeing, for example, that voters of color are more likely to use early voting, more likely to use same-day registration, less likely to have strict forms of government-issued ID. And this is based on a long history of voter disenfranchisement in this country that has taken decades to remedy. And in fact, that's really the theme of my book, Give Us the Ballot, is talking about the impact of the Voting Rights Act since 1965 and just how many problems there were with voting before the Voting Rights Act was passed and just how much progress we have made since then, but also the fact that there have been continued barriers to the ballot box in the decades since that. We didn't solve the problem of voting discrimination in 1965, that it's been an ongoing struggle and one that continues to this day. So there are some constituencies that lean Republican that could be burdened here, but I think it's more Democratic voters. However, I look at this not through the lens of partisanship, but through the lens of American history, that we have unfortunately a very long history in this country of disenfranchising people. And I don't think we should be doing it again unless we have a very, very compelling reason to do so. And I don't believe that that's the situation today. I think we're needlessly making it harder for many people to vote when we instead should be making it easier to vote, that we still have in this day and age a quarter of Americans who aren't even registered to vote, for example. And those are the problems we should be trying to fix.
Ari Berman is with us this half hour. If you've just joined us, senior contributing writer for The Nation, also author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari is also someone who grew up in Iowa. Fairfield, right, Ari?
Yep.
All right. Very good. Email from Leslie, who is listening in Des Moines. She asks, what is the role of ALEC? This is the American Legislative Executive Council in pushing voter ID laws in state legislatures.
So ALEC is a group that pairs corporate interests with state legislatures. And so they're a group that's very influential, but not a lot of people know about them. And they've done things like drafted, for example, the Stand Your Ground gun laws, for example. And ALEC is a group that actually wrote mock voter ID laws. So in 2008, the Supreme Court upheld Indiana's voter ID law. That was the first challenge to these sort of laws. And after that, ALEC began to basically give state legislators sample voter ID bills. And we began to see after the 2010 election, when Republicans had control of all of these states, that these laws proliferated in virtually identical form, whether it was in Wisconsin or in Texas or in other states. And so I think that they have been a very influential group behind the scenes, and I think it's an example of the fact that this wasn't just something that states were necessarily considering on their own. This was something that, you know, very powerful interests in the conservative movement and the Republican Party were pushing.
Mm-hmm. Andy on our Facebook page writes for you, Ari, the Democratic primary seems proof that rigging an election in 2016 is possible. The exit polls in several states were off by multiple percentage. New York, Missouri, offhand, writes Andy, off on these points, which usually indicates election gaming. Also, thousands of voters had their party affiliation unexpectedly dropped or chances. I'm not sure what that means, but we get the gist of Andy's question there on Facebook. Respond to that.
So I don't believe that the Democratic primary was rigged. I think there were problems with voting in a bunch of different states, but I don't think it was something that Hillary Clinton did to try to disenfranchise Bernie Sanders supporters. And indeed, if you look at lots of the voting problems, like the fact that there were five-hour lines in Phoenix, Arizona, because that county decided to cut 70% of their polling places. In fact, many Clinton voters would have been burdened by these kind of things because Hillary Clinton was winning lots of votes from voters of color, for example, who tend to be the target of these new voting restrictions. So I think there were problems with voting in the primaries, but I don't think the primary was rigged, and I think that's the wrong conversation we should be having about voting. I believe the much larger threat are from these Republican-backed voting restrictions, and I don't think they were trying to disenfranchise Hillary supporters or Bernie supporters. I think the goal has been to try to make it harder more broadly for Democratic-leaning voters to be able to cast a ballot. With regards to the exit polls were off in some states. They're often off in some states. They were accurate in a lot of other states. And so many people who run these exit polls, who are professional pollsters, have looked into this and saw that there was no foul play. So I think it's disturbing that this myth, honestly, is still around, but the fact is everyone who's looked into this from a nonpartisan perspective, including myself because I was non-aligned during the primary, I did not support Clinton or Sanders, has shown that while there were voting problems, that the primary was not systematically rigged.
Mm-hmm. When you look back over the past decades and how voting rights have evolved in this country since the Voting Rights Act in 1965 and the ebb and flow, I suppose, since then and where we are today, place us in a little bit of historical context and tell us then where you think we're heading now.
So you have to really think about what the country was like before the passage of the Voting Rights Act. That in Selma, Alabama, for example, where the Bloody Sunday March took place, where people like Congressman John Lewis were brutally beaten, only 383 of 15,000 eligible black voters were registered to vote. That in the county next to Selma, Alabama, Lowndes County, which was 80% African American, there wasn't a single African American who was registered to vote. That's how bad things were in this country before the Voting Rights Act was passed, and the Voting Rights Act solved this problem. It was an incredibly important piece of legislation, one of the most important pieces of legislation ever passed in American history, and a large part of my book, Give Us the Ballot, is devoted to telling the story of this progress. But the fact is there has also been a 50-year effort to try to roll back the Voting Rights Act and similar pieces of legislation from the 1960s. That efforts to try to prevent people from voting didn't end in 1965, and indeed there have been massive struggles over voting rights in the decades after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And I think we're in one of these periods today where the right to vote remains very hotly contested along partisan lines, sometimes along regional lines, as we're seeing sometimes even within primaries. And so I think when you look at American history, often it's the moments of the greatest progress that follow the greatest backlash. And that was true after the Civil War, when we passed the 13th, the 14th, and 15th Amendment, and then began to see things like literacy tests and poll taxes introduced in response to that, or whether it's the election of the first black president, which is then followed by a bunch of attempts in different states to make it harder to vote. So I think we are in another period in American history where we're still having these really, really serious debates over the right to vote.
Mm-hmm. In the few seconds we have remaining, so what are the factors that will decide where we go in the future?
Well, I think part of it is what the courts say. I think part of it is the future of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is who gutted the Voting Rights Act, so they can do things differently. Part of it's the Congress. The Congress in previous years has protected the right to vote, has reauthorized the Voting Rights Act. They've been missing from the scene, being hobbled by gridlock. And I think part of it will just be the public. Does the public decide that they want to make it harder to vote, or is there a backlash to these efforts? And does the public say, like in Florida 2012, where there were seven-hour lines to vote, this is unacceptable. This is not who we can be. We can't be the greatest democracy in the world when we have all of these states and all of these places making it harder to vote.
Ari Berman, thank you very much. The time has flown by. Thank you. Senior contributing writer for The Nation, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, very attached to Hawkeye football, as you mentioned, and we'll get back to you to see if they have an undefeated season and if they do better than last year with their season, huh? Ari, can we put you on a sports analyst position too?
I don't know if I'd necessarily be qualified for that, but happy to weigh in.
All right.
See you later.
Thanks, Ari. Ari Berman. Coming up in just a moment, presidential historian Tim Walch will be with us with his recommended reading for the next president. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest recently wrote, I guess you could call it an open letter to the next president of the United States. It reads, Mr. or Ms. President, you can't go wrong in reading any or all of the biographies below. There are many excellent biographies of past presidents, but these books are among the best written and thoughtful biographies by gifted storytellers. I am recommending you read all of these books to get a sense of how your predecessors handled the most difficult job in the world and how historians have judged their performances. The past is not a prescription for the future, but you will be wiser for learning about the select few who have led our nation. Those words in that open letter, so to speak, written by presidential historian Tim Walch. We've had him on our program before, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim Walch, Welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks, Ben. I'm glad to be here at Hubris Anonymous, because who am I to recommend to either candidate?
Well, we think quite highly of you here, and so we think it's good to have you in this position. We want to reach out to our listeners,
sure,
though.
Sure, you bet.
Perhaps to lessen the hubris.
And they've that's right. Let's bring wisdom in.
River to River listeners, if you could recommend one book to this year's presidential candidates, what would it be? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, and tell us why, of course. Email us is also a way to do this, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, tweet us at IPR Talk, or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. So this is interesting. Let's you have quite a list here. Let's give us a taste, and I see,
okay,
at the top of your list are books that focus on the early republic.
Right. And
very early. Go back
well,
there
keep
with
in mind, and I'm sure listeners know about the extraordinary hip-hop musical Hamilton and the central role that Alexander Hamilton made in the formation of our government. They may not know that Ron Chernow, who wrote the big book about Hamilton, also has written a wonderful biography of George Washington, who found himself at the center of this vortex, this conflict between Hamilton on one side and Thomas Jefferson on the other. And you throw in John Adams, who was perpetually either angry or hurt or whatever, and you have a real maelstrom. So the notion somehow that the kind of political agitation we see today and the acrimony and the bitterness and hostility and the hypocrisy is unique to this election, should go back and read Ron Chernow on George Washington. It's called Washington, A Life, or David McCullough on John Adams. The title is John Adams. Or perhaps Joseph Ellis on Thomas Jefferson, or John Meacham on Thomas Jefferson, because you see the real tension that existed within our republic. So there is a certain measure of experience and a sense of wisdom that comes from the fact that our politics has somehow worked itself out over the course of our history.
Mm-hmm. What might those books have in terms of lessons for a politician, a president, to deal with the acrimony? We see presidents in the modern era dealing with it in different ways. And there is a response, and it's how presidents respond.
If you're looking for the great presidents, if you're looking for the Washingtons or the Lincolns or the Franklin Roosevelts, look to their inaugural addresses in that common theme, which is come together, follow me. And that's really what you're looking for in presidential lives and in the biographies of these presidents, is to say, what can I learn from the lives of these great presidents, people who've acknowledged that they are great? And in fact, regardless of your political views, people would acknowledge those three presidents generally are considered the greatest within each of those centuries, that they shared that in common. They weren't all charismatic, but they all had that common theme: come together, follow me. And that's somewhat difficult, because in effect, I'm sure Donald Trump would say, come together and follow me, but it seems demagogic. So, you know, at times you have to be careful of ensuring that you're reaching out to the whole country.
Mm-hmm. Larry from El Cader, we're getting some input here to our question for our listeners with presidential historian Tim Walsh with us this half hour. If you could recommend one book to this year's presidential candidates, what would it be? And we're entertaining your suggestions as well as Tim's this hour. 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can email us. I think Larry from El Cader emailed us. He says, A Sand County Almanac by Iowa native Aldo Leopold.
Sure.
He writes, Leopold, the father of the modern conservation movement, a philosophical approach to why natural resources are so important to the future of our country. So I don't know if you know about
this book, but I
know you have science books.
It's been
books.
Many years since I've read that book. Another one that would be a recommended book is one that Neil deGrasse Tyson recommends, called Physics for Future Presidents, because we do need to have presidents who are cognizant of conservation, of the environment, of science, and we need to make sure we have a science council. One of the qualities that you see in the biographies that I've recommended biographies of Harry Truman, for example, is not only an interest in learning and reading, but an openness to new ideas. I mean, a person or a president who says, well, I know everything, I don't need any advice, is going to find himself in trouble. They need to be open to new ideas, to a complete debate and discussion before they make a decision. And many of the presidents, even presidents who haven't been deemed completely successful, have been open to discussion and deliberation.
1-866-780-9100. Let's go to our first caller. Nathan is joining us. Hi, Nathan. Do you have a book to suggest to our next president?
I do. It's a little tiny blue book that sits on my shelf, and it's the Collected Speeches of William Jennings Bryan. And the reason I would recommend that book is to show the next president that the economic inequality, the struggles of the working class of today are not new issues. They're not some unique feature of globalization. They are an inherent crisis that has crippled America for hundreds of years. And so if the next president could read what a proud, you know, rural Midwesterner, William Jennings Bryan, was saying 100 years ago, I think they would see how deeply embedded in the American character these problems are and how critically important it is that we address them today and forever.
Nathan, thank you for that suggestion.
Excellent.
I see Tim Walsh nodding his head in agreement.
And Bryan was one of those figures, a little bit like Trump, who came out, almost burst onto the scene in the 1890s and just overwhelmed the Democratic National Convention. A terrific convention speaker. I mean, just motivated the crowds moving forward. Eventually becomes Secretary of State in the first Wilson administration and resigns as a matter of principle when Wilson, in effect, enters World War I. He was a pacifist and certainly was not going to be a part of any government that would go to war.
Mm-hmm. I see on your list, Tim, also something that taps into certainly our time here when we're talking about the concentration of wealth into fewer and fewer hands, which data proves out. You have Doris Kearns Goodwin on Teddy Roosevelt, The Bully Pulpit, the title of her book from, what was that, 2011? I'm not sure how old that is. I interviewed her about
2014, I think.
Okay, so it was, yeah, I spoke with her about that.
Right.
So this is Theodore Roosevelt.
Right, Theodore Roosevelt.
Not Franklin, so we're in the early part of the 20th century, and we're talking about, like, trust busting.
And again, we're talking about the dreaded media, which, of course, is now a contemporary issue because, of course, muckraking journalism and the role of newspapers, partisan newspapers, yellow journalism is much a part of this. Theodore Roosevelt loved to read. I mean, in fact, we're talking about a book about a man who loved to read and write. He was a gifted writer as well. And, of course, he left office after two terms and decided he'd made the worst mistake of his life. And almost from 1909 going forward, he was planning to come back and run again for president.
And at that time, there were no limits.
No,
you could
right.
have a third and fourth term.
And his cousin Franklin proved that point, and that's why we have the amendment to the Constitution. But at the time, then you see the conflict between people who had been first friends and admirers and then rivals. And, of course, the conflict between Taft and T.R. would eventually lead to Woodrow Wilson becoming president of the United States. So, again, we see conflict and ego among and between our presidential candidates.
Tim Walsh is with us this half hour. The time going far too quickly for my liking, for sure, because I could talk about this all afternoon with Tim. Let me ask you this. What do we know about the reading habits of the presidential candidates from the main parties, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton?
Donald Trump is, by his own admission, not much of a reader. If you asked him for recommendations on books, he would start with The Art of the Deal, a book that he wrote with Tony Schwartz, I think his name is, 30 years ago now. But he also recommends The Art of War by Sun Tzu, with kind of a classic book in the public domain. And then All Quiet on the Western Front, the classic book about World War I. So Trump really would prefer to have almost anything given to him in brief memos of three pages or less, rather than having, he says he just doesn't have time to read. Hillary Clinton, however, has a broad reading list that includes books like Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch or the works of Maya Angelou. She likes Harlan Coben, which is kind of interesting, Elizabeth Gilbert. And on her list, I've been surprised, she recommends Decision Points by George W. Bush, Faith of My Fathers by John McCain. So I think that you see in Clinton a broad and diverse list, not outside the norm or mainstream. There's no obscure titles that I'm aware of, at least among the books she's recommending. But she, enjoys reading a variety of books, books by Barbara Kinsolver and Laura Hillebrand and so forth, as well as Walter Isaacson. So rich and diverse, I would say. With Donald Trump, it's more concentrated.
Mm-hmm. And a little excerpt from the Washington Post when they did an article about Donald Trump and his reading habits. He's said, according to the Washington Post in a series of interviews, he does not need to read extensively because he reaches the right decisions, in his words, with very little knowledge other than the knowledge already has, plus common sense, because I have a lot of common sense and I have a lot of business ability, quoting Donald Trump there. But you say also, and it's also raised in this article, and it's very interesting, we have a cluster of modern presidents who fall into the extensive reader category.
Right.
President Obama, Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush.
Exactly. In fact, George H.W. Bush was said to, between the years 2006 and 2008, to have read 186 books. You know, he had a reputation of not being very intellectual and somewhat inarticulate, but he was an avid reader. And I also know that any recommendation by a president of a book is a real bump for the author because it really leads to sales. I remember when Bill Clinton would often go off on Air Force One or a Marine One, the helicopter. If he had a book under his arm, the press would try to discern what it was. And I remember Sarah Paretsky had one of her books under Bill Clinton's arm when he was going off on vacation. And, boy, it led to putting it back on the bestseller list. So presidential recommendations of books are important. And it's a great way, again, to encourage reading. And it's something that we've had several first ladies, Laura Bush particularly, who established the National Book Festival in Washington, D.C., encouraging reading as part of their program. And we have a White House library because of a first lady as well.
Of course, in the era of the e-reader, we might not know what's on that tablet under that president's arm.
We won't, although some presidents are just old-fashioned and like the good old-fashioned codex and turn those pages,
Exactly.
So,
well, Brian is listening to this conversation. Let me remind you, if you just joined us, so happy always to have Tim Walch with us, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, giving us his view on the books that the next president should read to prepare, perhaps studying previous presidential lives, learning lessons there, but also novels on this list, classics as well. Let me go to an email from Brian, who is listening. He says it's got to be Moby Dick. It will make them feel proud to be an American reading the amazing prose and help them learn about the dangers of hubris.
Yeah. It is a stunning book, one of the great classics, obviously, of the canon. And it's, of course, a book that many, many people said they've read. It's kind of like War and Peace.
It's kind of hard to get into. I know, for personal experience.
The chapters on cetology, the study of whales, how to stay awake, drink massive amounts of coffee. But in truth, these are we should look at the great works. We should read Leaves of Grass. We should read Mark Twain and all the great books
as well. Why novels? Why works of fiction? Well, how does that inform a president who's dealing with real-world politics?
Right. And, in fact, the novels that I've got on the list that I've recommended, All Quiet on the Western Front, again, one that Donald Trump recommends, too, but For Whom the Bell Tolls, Catch-22, The Things That They Carried by Tim O'Brien or Phil Clay's Redeployment, particularly when it comes to the consequences of conflict or war. Presidents have kind of a unique responsibility in the sense that they can take us to war, and the consequences of war are often uncontrollable. And so what these books inform us is the consequences of war, and it helps almost in a metaphysical way a president or any person in power and authority to step back and say, what am I going to be – what will be the consequences or the unexpected consequences of what may happen from what, you know, what has been done.
Right. Unexpected consequences. You have on your list Barbara Tuchman's. It's been many years since I've read The Guns of August.
John F. Kennedy, before he was reading The Guns of August at about the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he said, this book informed my decision on not to go to war with the Soviet Union over the missiles in Cuba, because, of course, if you trigger a war, it could have led to the annihilation of the Western world.
You jumped on exactly on my next question. If we can trace in presidential history, you've just named one, where a president has said, I made a decision because of being informed by a certain book. And there's one
That's
right
exactly,
there, Barbara Tuchman.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are others. And, of course, presidents aren't necessarily going to be, touting books one after the other. But often, too, and I do this, I'm sure others do, too, if you look when a president delivers a speech from the Oval Office, look and see what books you see either on the desk or behind the desk. And sometimes you can tell from the spine, if you're that kind of a person, what the president is reading. And obviously, a book under a president's arm makes a big difference. Presidents read enormous amounts of written information and memoranda. They don't really have a lot of personal time. One book I really want to plug, and I keep going back to this book because I love David Brooks. He's on National Public Radio on a regular basis on All Things Considered with E.J. Dionne and others.
Yes.
And he has a book called The Road to Character. And the book talks about individuals, but it breaks down the fact that we really need to think of our lives as both having resume values and eulogy values. And I think there's a heavy emphasis in our presidential campaigns on resume values. I've done this. I've been Secretary of State. I've been a senator. I've done this and this. But it's what is said at your funeral. How did you impact individuals? And it's those eulogy values that we need to encourage. Character, courage, those sorts of things. Compassion. That's the sort of qualities that ultimately makes for a great president.
Mm-hmm. And we know from what we've seen of this election cycle so far that we have steered away, it seems, from being issue-oriented, focused, and really character-focused in terms of evaluating these two major party candidates.
Well, we spent most of the time, both sides have spent most of their time, trying to destroy their opponent. So it's really an election of destruction, not instruction. We're not really informing the voters about ourselves. We're saying, vote for me because the other guy's worse or the other woman is worse or whatever. And so in that sense, we end up with almost total annihilation. So the campaigns, and or at least the careers that we've seen among our presidents, the great presidents, you'll find, again, that they are they're inspirational. You know, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Look to those inaugural addresses. Look to the campaigns of those candidates to uplift. We want to be uplifted.
It's interesting, too, isn't it, the current president who looks to writing from everyday Americans for informing his decisions.
You know, every president.
Tell us about that.
Every president since Lincoln has had a process where they've had staff cull from the letters, thousands, tens of thousands of letters that the president receives every day from ordinary Americans. And these letters eventually end up in presidential libraries. And it's been kind of funny, for example, somebody who becomes prominent remembers having written a letter to the president 30 or 40 years ago. And my goodness, there it is in the presidential library. So there's one value. But these letters keep our presidents in touch with ordinary citizens. So the communication that goes on between a president and his people is important. And the president reads those letters and then often responds.
A couple minutes left. Let's throw out a suggestion from our listener, Chad. He emails and says, Grant by Gene Edward Smith.
Yes.
A fine literary portrait of an enigmatic and often underappreciated president, Ulysses S. Grant.
Exactly. And there's a William McFeely also has an excellent biography of Grant. And I do recommend the work of Gene Edward Smith. He has a new book out on George W. Bush. Not very complimentary, but he also has on my list a book about Dwight Eisenhower called Eisenhower in War and Peace, which is excellent. He's an excellent gifted writer of biographies.
Very quickly, you also get into science in our new digital age. Walter Isaacson.
Yes.
about hackers, geniuses, and
the
geeks.
Innovators, right.
The innovators.
And I also recommend David McCullough's The Wright Brothers. If you haven't read that, it's a relatively short book, but it shows about persistence, determination, problem solving. We're looking for books that offer us a path forward, not to destroy the world around us.
Mm-hmm. What books do you have on your reading list yet to get to that you've seen come out recently, Tim Walch?
Well, I just finished, and I'm very proud to say, kind of going back, I've just finished the Chernow book on Alexander Hamilton. It's about 750 pages.
Wow. That's some summer reading.
It is, and I've been now gone into the work of Eric Larson. If people haven't read Dead Wake, about the sinking of Lusitania, and I'm now doing In the Garden of Beasts, which is about, of course, the chance circumstance of an academic historian ending up as an ambassador to Germany at the time of Adolf Hitler.
Both of those. I read everything by Eric Larson.
Yeah.
He is tremendous, isn't he? And I've had the pleasure of interviewing on this program, actually, as well.
And the fundamental quality of a good historian is to be a storyteller. Tell the story. Be truthful to the resources and the documents, but tell a story and tell it well.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all the time, unfortunately, we have. Tim Walch is with us, presidential historian, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim, we've got to think of another excuse back to have you back on.
another meeting of Hubris Anonymous.
All right. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.